Hello. In this audio snippet, we will continue talking about the pillars of the new American Constitution, the 10 pillars. And we have basically gone through the first eight. And as we've said before, the first five have to do with defining authority and its nature. And the other five define the rights of the individual, and we have discussed the first three individual rights, which are pillar 6, 7, and 8. And pillar number 6 being the right to life, which, as we explained before, has to do with the right to freedom. Freedom and life are two sides of the same coin, you could say, and that right to life includes, under its umbrella, lots of things such as freedom of speech, freedom of movement, and other practical things that we associate with freedom. And when we studied that pillar, we described the concepts that are associated with the right to life, such as the right to grow, and many other other things. But we won't revisit the whole pillar, but that's an important pillar that we must have in the Constitution. And then we describe the seventh pillar, which is the second human right, which is the right to privacy. And we associated it with the concept of nakedness. And we talked about how the right to privacy has been so misunderstood that it has actually become this pastoral shield to block criminals, wrongdoers, from proper judgment, because nakedness has been misconstrued or misunderstood as wrongdoing. And once we understand the concept of privacy from the concept of human nakedness or vulnerability, then it becomes much easier to understand its limits, to properly defend it, and to prevent it being misused. And in future audio snippets, we'll be talking about going through the Constitution, through the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Amendments, which, if I remember correctly, are more or less the amendments that define privacy in a very jumbled way in the current American Constitution. We'll study those and see all the mistakes that are there, especially in the 5th Amendment, which is probably one of the worst amendments in all the Constitution because of the extent of the damage that it has produced. And in essence, the 5th Amendment is a microcosm of something that's very wrong with the American culture. It's something that's endemic and has been haunting us from the beginning, and it's having its greatest consequences at the time of this recording. And that problem is that basic idea that in the American culture, it's been the attitude that we encounter a problem, we try to deal with the problem and try to find a solution for it as quickly as possible. Once we find a solution that seems to kind of deal with the majority of the problem that we saw on the surface, then we are okay with it. And then we move on to the next thing, believing that as long as the solution that we have applied seems to be kind of controlling the problem, or resolving what was concerning us about that problem, then we can move on and there's no need to think about the solution that we've implemented, no need to really analyze it more profoundly to see if it matches the reality. And I know this sounds like a very simple or simplistic statement, but it's at the heart of a lot of the problems in this country. And it's that idea that the truth is independent of us. We don't decide what truth is. We don't decide what reality is. We can decide what we think reality is, what we think truth is, but we can't change the truth. If a car is coming towards you at 55 miles per hour and it's about to hit you head on, It does not matter what you think about the car. It doesn't matter if you think that metal is like cotton, soft as cotton, or that the car is imaginary. It does not matter. What matters is that car is coming right at you, and if it hits you, it's going to hit you hard and it's going to hurt. Reality is independent of us, and our purpose is to understand or to find out what that reality is and have our attitudes and everything we do match the reality. We don't decide what reality is, and that's a thing that liberals have a tendency to do. Whenever reality does not match their perception, all they do is change the wording, change the definition of things, and then they do this selective thing where they shut off anything that contradicts their ideology, and then suddenly, okay, now we're back. That cognitive dissonance disappears, and then they just are back in this safe world where everything is according to their point of view. And that's why, for example, with the current lethal injections that are being injected at the time of this recording around the world that are killing hundreds of thousands and millions of people, injuring them very severely with blood clots and myocarditis and pericarditis and whatever. That lethal injection has been called labeled a vaccine. And everybody knows that if you have a vaccine for a certain disease, by the very definition of the word, how we have used the word throughout our history, throughout medical history, we believe that a vaccine will make us immune from the disease it is for. Or in other words, it will prevent us contracting the disease. And in the majority of cases, it will not only protect us from contracting the disease, it will also prevent us transmitting it to others, unless it's a so-called leaky vaccine. And that term means that, yes, well, it's a vaccine that protects us from getting a disease, but it does not prevent us transmitting it to someone else. And in that case, if I am vaccinated, and it happens to be a leaky vaccine, then I may transmit the disease to others. It's like I have the virus doesn't do me any harm because I'm immune to it, but I accidentally transmit it to someone else, and if that other person is not vaccinated, then they are in danger. So in the real world, a vaccine protects the vaccinated, and the unvaccinated are the ones unprotected. And they're the ones who have to worry that they're going to get sick because they don't have the vaccine. The vaccinated just can go on with their lives, and the unvaccinated are the ones who will have to kind of deal with the consequences of not taking the vaccine or take the risk. Ironically, under the current scheme, the constant thing is the vaccinated are the so-called vaccinated are angry at the unvaccinated, saying, how dare you put us in danger? And just that just goes to show you the total disconnect between the reality and their perception. So we see there an example of how we have an injection that does not prevent you getting the disease. In fact, the data clearly shows that the more a population is exposed or has been fooled into taking the injection, the more cases of disease seem to appear, of infection and disease. And age groups that were practically immune to this virus are now getting attacked by it, because usually the virus was attacking older people from ages 65 and over with comorbidities, conditions that that were already having them sick, and that made them susceptible to severe disease at their later age. And I think that, for example, in Italy, the average age of the people who died from the virus was around 70 or 75 years old, 75 years of age. But now with these injections, we're seeing younger people getting sick, and they're not only getting sick from the variants of the virus, they're now having heart conditions, myocarditis, pericarditis, and stuff. Like for example, recently, there was this like today I saw the story of this football player. I think his name was Alphonse Davis or something like that. And he apparently got really sick from the virus. He's a Canadian footballer, soccer player, and he has some issues now because of the injection. And we see football player after football player either collapsing on the pitch or having to retire, like Sergio Aguero and so forth. So that are being debilitated and practically forced to retire from their profession, a lot of them, because of these injections. So there's this reality, and the liberal just says, no, we don't believe what we're seeing because it contradicts our ideology, so we just switch things around. That's why, for example, the definition of the word vaccine was modified by the CDC, I think in August of last year, or at some point they said, okay, this obviously is not a vaccine, so we just have so instead of admitting it's not a vaccine, what we're going to do is just change the definition of a vaccine. Oh, it's something that helps you deal with the symptoms better. Well, that would mean that taking a headache pill would make it a vaccine. You have a headache and you take the headache pill and you feel better. And then based on the new definition of vaccine, that means that a headache pill is a vaccine against headaches. So you see the foolishness of that disconnect between the reality that's out there and the reality we want to maintain. And the liberals just redefine terms willy-nilly. They don't care. They jumble facts around. They move statistics. They do all these things just to have them fit their thinking, because the true reality is irrelevant to them. And on the other side, we have conservatives who they don't do the same thing that liberals do, but what they do is that they, in a certain sense, disconnect themselves from the reality and just stay within this limited castle that they live in. And as long as there are no problems, no overt problems within the castle, then the rest of the world could collapse for all they care. Everything could be burning all around them. But as long as their little house is nice and safe, then all other problems are irrelevant. But the problem is that if every house around you is burning, if you don't deal with the situation, your own house is going to start to burn. And the problem is conservatives, when they see their house burning, they suddenly react in frustration, but they don't realize that because of their indifference, this fire is coming into their house that they could have handled. And they would not only have been able to save their own house, they would have been able to save other people's houses. But conservatism just creates this implosion of this self-centeredness. And that's why young people are so opposed or kind of turned off by conservatism. Because when they get close to it, all they feel is staleness, this self-centeredness of this life of very of just of thinking about yourself and not worrying about others and not worrying about higher causes or principles. And that's why they go to the liberal that will offer them all these things, but with deception. So we have this disconnect in the American culture between the reality, between the reality and what we perceive. So when we see a problem, we try to find a solution for it, and we apply the best solution we can come up with at the time, which seems to cover most of the problems, and then we move on because we are not concerned about the metaphysical reality. It's all from a practical standpoint. And because we don't worry about the actual invisible reality to us, to the American psyche, that is nonsense. That is a waste of time. Because of that, then we don't aim for the right solution, and eventually that problem that solution that we applied over the problem starts falling apart. And that's what we've been constantly doing. With the right to privacy, we have been kind of doing that. Whenever we encounter a problem that revolves around privacy, we just try to patch it up and put something around it and then move on. And we don't worry about, okay, did we get the metaphysical reality down correctly when we wrote out these laws or these statutes? And are we getting the general principle? Are we really understanding what the right to privacy is? And the answer is no. But we just keep going. And then things start collapsing, and then we start complaining, but it's just the consequence of these decisions that we constantly make. So we mentioned the right to privacy in pillar number seven. Then the eighth pillar is the right to property, and we try to describe in detail like seven sub-pillars within that eighth pillar of the right to property. And now we're moving into the ninth pillar. And the ninth pillar is probably a little anti-intuitive. If you think about it, it's not if I went out on the street and asked people, what are the fundamental human rights, they would start giving a whole bunch of a list of things like the right to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, right to bear arms, and all these things, depending on who you ask. But all these laundry lists, most of it can be kind of gathered around the right to life that we have, as we have described it. The right to privacy would be mentioned by a lot of people, especially liberals. And then the right to property, which would probably be mentioned by a few conservatives, not too many. But if you mentioned it to them, they'd go, "Oh yeah, definitely, we have the right to property." So those are rights that people would readily recognize or mention on their own. But the right that we're about to describe is a little unnatural, or not unnatural, but not immediately evident. But once you hear it makes sense, and it's so fundamental, that right, that it has to be one of the pillars of the Constitution. And I know that a lot of people would, if you mention the right to them, they would say, "Okay, yeah, I believe in that right." But would they put it in the top 10 of rights? I don't think so. The vast majority would probably see it as like a lower level right. But no, it's a fundamental right, and it's the right to a fair reputation. In other words, you as an individual have the right to have a reputation that is in accordance with who you are and what you are and what you do. So if some if for example someone call let's say that you're at a company and somebody accuses you of being a thief, that you steal office equipment, and that is a damage to your reputation. Now, if you are actually stealing office equipment, then your right to a fair reputation has not been violated, obviously, because it's the right to a fair reputation, not a right to a good reputation. If you're a thief and a thug and a criminal and a murderer and all these things, then if you get called all those names, you have no choice but to shrug your shoulders and say, "Yeah, I guess so." But if you're not, then your reputation has been damaged, and there's something very violating about that. When someone attacks you and makes false accusations against you, your reputation, that reputation that you deserve to have, is damaged, and there is a personal sense of violation about that. The concept of the right to a fair reputation is in our American system at the present time. The libel and slander laws that are in place throughout the country. And let me just give you like a formal definition that usually this the right to a fair reputation is the term, the legal term that's used in the American culture, you could say is defamation. And defamation is a tort that encompasses false statements of fact that harm someone else's reputation. And that's more or less the formal definition of it. And just so you know, a tort is a wrongful act or an infringement of a right that leads to legal liability. In other words, there's tort and there is crime. Crime means you go to prison if you're convicted. With tort, if I'm not mistaken, it means that if you're convicted or found guilty, then you have to pay up. So it's one is civil in nature, one is criminal, the other is criminal. And defamation has been more or less associated with civil lawsuits. So if someone says something slanderous about you, then you can sue them and get money from them because they slandered you in some way. But I believe that the right is so fundamental that I think we've made the mistake of just limiting it to a civil penalty. I believe that it also has and should have criminal consequences. In other words, people should, in some circumstances, go to jail for having violated your right to a fair reputation. And just as a side note, in legal terms, there's a difference between libel and slander. They sound like the same thing, but libel is more or less the term used for written attacks against your reputation, and slander is more verbal oral attacks. So if someone publishes an article, a news article that slant that that attacks your reputation unfairly, or smears you unfairly, that is libel. And it but if someone is out there, like at the office, spreading rumors that you are a thief, that would be slander. So that's kind of the difference between the two. Now, to get an understanding of this right, we have to kind of do a switch in the perspective. And unfortunately, in our history, we have basically associated the right to this right to a fair reputation, or contrasted it with the right of free speech, the right to life, in the form of the right to freedom of speech. And that has kind of belittled, or kind of reduced or diminished the value of this right, and has prevented us getting a right perspective on it. Just so you know, for example, sorry, before that, before saying what I was about to say, part of the reason why we have the false, or not the false, but an incorrect perspective of this right to a fair reputation is because it's not in the Constitution. If you look through all the amendments, there's nothing about libel or slander or the smearing of a person's reputation anywhere in the Constitution. And that's why we do have libel laws and, you know, slander laws and all that in the American system, but it's no thanks to the Constitution that is in place right now. It's mostly state laws, state libel laws. Every state defines their own libel laws. And then we have this, the nonsense of federalism that we have spoken of so many times, that in one state, if you do libel in a certain way, you get penalized in one way. And if you go to another state, you may be penalized differently or not be penalized at all. So we have all this this hodgepodge of heterogeneous laws defining libel, but it's at the state level, and because there's no constitutional definition or kind of concept of it, then it's always been defined when it comes into conflict with the freedom of speech. And just to give you an example, in America, we had the, I think it was called the Alien and Seditions Act of 1798. And that Alien and Seditions Act was famous because it was an early example of what some might consider government tyranny, trying to suppress opposition to government policies, and the backdrop of that, of those acts, were some people call it the quasi war that we had with France. It was an undeclared naval war with France that lasted for a couple of years from 1798 to 1800. And the backdrop of that was that in 1793, I think it was Louis the XV's head got separated from his body. As you know, in 1789, on July 14th, 1789, the famous storming of the Bastille and the start of the French Revolution, which eventually led to the formation of the first, what's called the First Republic, the First French Republic, the overthrow of the monarchy, and kind of the beginning of the end of monarchical control in Europe. The French Revolution was very important in that sense that it kind of ended the hegemony, the domination of the monarchical system in Europe. And obviously, it had excesses and things that were not right about it. Don't get me wrong, but in that sense, it was a very momentous thing in European and world history. So, as the First Republic was formed, then they captured Louis the XV, and I hope I'm getting the numbers right. I think it was Louis the XV. Or it must have been Louis XVI, one of those two fellows. In 1793, there was this public execution, and then the first French Republic was started. And what happened was that when that happened, the U.S. Made a very, yeah, I'm sorry, it was Louis the 16th, not Louis the 15th. Louis the 15th was the Sun King, I think. He was like the greatest French king ever or something, I forget. But Louis the 16th, his successor, was not that successful. And as you know, his head was chopped off. So the thing is that in 1793, when that happened, Congress in the U.S. suspended payments of French loans, because we had the French had lent us money, and during the American Revolutionary War, and we were still paying back. And then when the monarchy collapsed and the First Republic emerged in 1793 officially, when Louis the 16th was executed, then we said, oh, okay, We owed the money to Louis and the king, and now that he's gone, forget about it. You know, that's what they said in New York. Forget about it, and we're not going to pay you anymore. Which is kind of ironic because the U.S. was a republic itself, and by saying that the debt was canceled when the king died was like saying, no, we recognize kings, but we don't recognize republics. So you see the hypocrisy there, the irony, and the French who had been there for us, you know, when we needed it the most, when we were fighting the British, now that we didn't need them anymore, it's like, okay, no mas payments for you. And so that kind of started some tensions between France and the US, and then that got escalated when we entered into the Jay Treaty with Britain. There had been some conflicts with Britain, and we signed this treaty called the Jay Treaty, where we were kind of making peace with Britain. And the French were in conflict with Britain at the time, and they saw that as a big time betrayal because we had some alliances, some treaties of alliance and commerce with them that I think were established in 1778. And the French said, "Hey, you signed some treaties with us, and now you're signing a treaty with our enemy, the British. What's wrong with you? And on top of that, you're not paying us our loans." So that so the French started kind of attacking American ships, and it got pretty bad. And so there was this war between France and the U.S. Sadly enough, a naval war during that period of 1798 to 1800. And that kind of began to put the federal government to the test because in the US, because the federal government is the one that is in charge of you know, raising a military force and declaring war and all these things. And because there was no declared war, you know, some people were complaining, hey, you know, what are we doing here? You know, this is there's no declaration of war. The federal government does not have the power to be doing these things, fighting the French like this and all that. And because there was this controversy, then the government at the time of John Adams, the second president of the US, he and you know the people in Congress passed the Alien and Seditions Act that basically said that you know you were not supposed to say anything that seemed injurious to the reputation of the government, and it allowed the president to even imprison and deport non-citizens if they were deemed quote dangerous, you know, if they were not friendly, or if they were from a hostile nation. So it basically criminalized false statements. It's kind of ironic that I do believe that the right to a fair reputation should be tied to criminal penalties, not just civil, you know, monetary penalties. But in this case, it was being applied, but applied in a wrong way. But it was the reputation of the government. And it was in contrast with the people's right to say what they wanted to say against the government. And I think that's part of the problem we started having with the right to a fair reputation because we began to see it as a battle between the right to say whatever you want and the right of someone else's reputation. And also the contrast here is that we're not really talking about the reputation of an individual. We're talking about the reputation of a government. Because, you know, obviously, if you're criticizing the war, you're not just criticizing John Adams or so and so. You are criticizing the whole system. But what we're talking about is the right of an individual to his or her fair reputation. That should be the center of it. And eventually, just so you know, these Alien and Sedition Acts were much hated, And I believe that had a lot to do with Thomas Jefferson winning the election in 1800, because the Federalists, like people like Alexander Hamilton, who believed that we needed to have a strong federal government, were for these acts because, you know, the states were always, you know, struggling for power because we had this Confederate system, the stupid Confederate system that we have talked about before. And the federal government was weak, and Hamilton and the Federalists, the people of the Federalist Party, wanted a strong government, and this was a way to kind of solidify this weak government that was kind of starting up in this new republic. You know, it was a baby nation, a baby government, and they needed to solidify it and strengthen it. And they did it in the wrong way, you could say, but it was because the Constitution was just so restrictive in what the federal government could do in a very impractical way. And so they had to kind of pull from wherever they could to solidify that, but that created a lot of antagonism from the public. And then James Madison and Thomas Jefferson kind of united, you could say, and in their with their Democratic Republican Party, that was the name of it, Democratic Republican Party, they were able to win the election in 1800, and Thomas Jefferson was then president for the next 8 years. And once he went into office, you know, the alien these acts expired in 1800, but it must be said that the Alien Enemies Act that was part of this remains in effect, and it was kind of the basis for a lot of things that have been done since then, including like the Gulf War and the Vietnam War, and other acts that have been done to imprison alleged dangerous enemy aliens and things like that. That was just a bit of history on the beginning of this controversy about the right to a fair reputation, but in this case it was the right of the government to have a fair reputation according to them. But aside from that, libel laws began to develop across the states because there was nothing in the Constitution that protected your right to a fair reputation. And up until like the latter half of the 20th century, you could say that the law seemed to favor, in lawsuits, the law seemed to favor those who were suing for reputational harm. So, and in many cases, even if the person was saying things that were true, or saying things that were opinion, that you know they were still susceptible to a lawsuit. So in that sense, there was a lot of restriction. It's as if libel was considered an unprotected form of speech, not protected by the First Amendment. The weird thing was that, generally, if you sued someone for defamation, the burden of proof was on the person you sued. In other words, it's as if the law assumed that you were, that the person suing, saying, oh, I'm being defamed, that he was right, and that the person who is being accused, his statements are false, and that then this person has to prove to the court to the state, that his statements are true, as opposed to the person who was, suing, saying, "Hey, he said this about me that's not true, and I can prove that it's not true." No, the burden of proof was on the accused, which is kind of odd. Kind of violates that innocent until proven guilty thing that everybody keeps repeating all the time. But that's how it was. And then things started changing, you could say, around 1964. And it was in a famous case that it was the New York Times versus Sullivan, Sullivan. It was this lawsuit that reached the Supreme Court, and that's when you could say that the libel laws kind of were constitutionalized in a way. And that's when finally states' libel laws became subject to the free speech protections of the First Amendment. And just to make it short, what happened with the New York Times versus Sullivan case was that in 1960, in March of 1960, the New York there was this advert that came out on the New York Times. And it was an advert sponsored by a group that was, a civil rights group that wanted to, promote civil rights and expose what was happening in the South and all that. And they wrote this story, if I'm not mistaken, about something that was going on in Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama. And I think it all started with some students who went to I think some eating place that where they wanted to eat. I think it was in the courthouse, cafeteria or something, or the it was I believe some sort of a government building or something. Some people wanted to eat. Some black students demanded food, and they were ejected, and not and I think they were ejected from the school they were attending because they did this, and that stirred up some trouble down south, and then the New York Times published this advertisement. That was trying to kind of like draw attention to what was happening in Alabama with this incident, and they started reporting some things about that the police surrounded the school and that they had put Martin Luther King in jail 7 times, and that they had padlocked the some cafeteria so that the students would starve and not be able to eat and things like that. So they kind of wrote all these things, but a lot of what they wrote was exaggerations. They said Martin Luther King had been put in jail 7 times. It was only 4 times. I mean, that doesn't justify the 4 times, but it wasn't 7. And that thing that the Alabama police was kind of coming in to surround and circle the place as it was some sort of attack on that place was not true. They were just nearby, and the story that they had padlocked the cafeteria so that the students would starve was not true either. All of it was kind of fabricated. And what happened was that Sullivan, who was, I guess, in a way, the quote police commissioner, I think his title was a little more complex than that, but I think for all intents and purposes, we can call him the police commissioner in Montgomery, Alabama, said, "Oh, we didn't do any of this, or a lot of this we didn't do, or not in the way that it's been portrayed here." And he sued the New York Times. And he sued in Alabama, and Alabama said, "Yeah, you're right," as expected, as you would expect. And he, I think, he won like a $50,000 lawsuit or something like that. But it was appealed, and it reached all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court eventually ended up overturning Alabama's decision. And said, "No, the New York Times cannot be. This is not libel, and they have the right to print this." And they reversed the verdict, and that's how it ended. And that was the first time that, in a sense, libel laws in the states became subject to the federal level, or what is said in the Constitution about the First Amendment rights of freedom of speech. I, even though I obviously don't agree with what happened in the South and all these things that are wrong, it is sad that the nine justices, at least in a majority of them, I forget what the, I think it was 6-3 or 5-4, I'm not sure, but they basically said, yeah, the New York Times is free to speak out, and because the advertisement did not mention Sullivan by name, Sullivan the police commissioner, they said, no, this is not libel, and go away. But they never forced the New York Times to retract, and that is one thing that you do find in many state libel laws, that there's this retraction clause where you are required, in a sense, to retract your statement or avoid penalties if you admit that you were wrong and retract your publication. But in this case, they just let it be, and that's how the libel laws became constitutionalized or subject to the Constitution in a kind of very odd sense. And that all just shows how the lack of structure that the founding fathers left behind, with not defining so many things clearly, forces to just improvise. You know, this whole country for 200 years has been one big night at the improvising over and over again. And instead of us realizing, okay, there are some gaps in the Constitution, which we have to shore them up, we've just kept going. And then we started defining these complex laws where other cases started coming out. There was a case in 1974. I forget the name of it, but I think it was Whalen versus Roe. In 1974, it was a case related to New York state laws that were gathering patient information because they wanted to control drug abuse. So they wanted to, they started keeping this database. Doctors were required to report the name of the, you know, the doctor prescribing the drug, what pharmacy dispensed the drug, what drug was dispensed, and the dosage. And they had to record the name, the address, and the age of the patient. And they were storing this in the, you know, Department of State, New York Department of State database. And this was in the days of when the computers were beginning to take hold of our lives. So now they had computers that were able to store all this information, and someone sued. This, I think it was in 1977, this happened. And then, what, as it turns out, the Supreme Court, decided in favor of New York State and said, no, yeah, they can keep those things as long as they don't, use it for something else. They have the right to maintain that information because the states have the authority to control these things. So it's like the Supreme Court said, yeah, I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution limiting the states on what they can do and not do. As long as they don't go overboard, we can't really hold them back. So, you know, we complain about the intrusion of things. Well, the problem has been here for a long, long time. We just have refused to deal with it. And what began to happen was that we're having a situation where when the Constitution is not clear, we start defining things as we go. And what we did was say, okay, now there are two categories of people, or three categories of people that we have to look at. There are public figures. Then there's like a middle category of something like public for a limited purpose public figure. And then there is a private figure or private person. And it depends on who you are attacking with your words or the libel supposed libel, that things change. If you attack a public official, then if the public official sues you, they have to show malice. Like you are maliciously attacking them. It's not just your personal opinion. You're just attacking. They have to prove malice. And if you're if you're a public figure for a limited purpose, if you're a private person, but you inject yourself into a public controversy, then for a season, for a moment, for a limited time or a limited scope, you are, for all intents and purposes, a public figure. And then again, if the public figure sues you for libel, they have to prove malice. And then there's the private person. The private person only has to prove negligence. So they don't have to prove malice. So we start doing all these complicated things, but we never get to the root of the problem. And that's what we have to change. And just to get started on the concept that we have to deal with here, let's forget about the freedom of speech for a second. Because if we always see the right to a fair reputation from that perspective, we're going to miss the right itself. So let's think about this. Okay, let's not think about the government or a public official, because that's where we start getting confused. And that's when we start making divisions. Okay, there's libel against a public official, libel against a private individual. No. Let's think from the individual perspective, because these are individual rights. The right of the individual. I'm an individual. Okay. When will my reputation be attacked? And you have to think about that. When will my reputation be attacked? And to get a sense of that, just think about what life is like in a communist country. In a communist country, if you say anything against the government, then what the government starts doing is that they come after you. And they don't just come after you with, putting you in jail or things like that. They start destroying your name in the public arena. And that's the heart of the thing. If you're a nobody and your words have no effect, they have no reason to fear you. So they might as well just ignore you. You know, like if there's a crazy person who is mentally deranged, some sort of mental deficiency, and he's like a crazy person, shouting obscenities at some communist leader, the communist leader will just laugh him off as a clown. But if it's a person that is saying things and doesn't look like a crazy deranged individual, then the communist leader will say, "Hey, we have to stop that guy." Why do you think they are afraid of those words? Because they know that guy looks reasonable, and his words are saying a lot of things that are true. And the problem is, if we let him talk, then a lot of people are going to listen to him and start agreeing with him. And then we're going to have this whole population turning on us. And it's going to be more difficult for us to control people. So, because the deranged, the crazy person, who has, his hair is all messed up and he hasn't taken a shower in 15 weeks, no one's going to listen to him. No one cares because he's crazy. So whatever he says is irrelevant, is harmless to the communist leader. But if it's a person who looks like an intelligent person, is saying cogent things and saying a lot of things that are true, that hit right on the nose, he's dangerous. And because he's dangerous, what they do is they don't just imprison him. They go after him in terms of his reputation. They call him, he's a liar, he's against the people, he is pro-rich, pro-the bourgeoisie, pro-this, pro-that, pro-the-other, and he does not have the intentions of the poor people at heart. He's evil, he only cares about making money, and he's lying about the great leader, saying all these things that are not true. So they start attacking and destroying his reputation because that's their way of discrediting the person so that other people will say, no, I'm not going to listen to him. He is for the wealthy. He is for the rich. He is for, for denying my rights as a member of the proletariat. So, and he said all these lies. My leader said that he said all these things, and my leader says they're not true. Hence, he's a liar. So I'm not going to believe him. So that's how they do it. They attack a person. They destroy a person's reputation. And it's interesting to me that as I was meditating on how to say all these things, and I apologize for the messy way in which it has come out, but today a story came out, which was very saddening to me, about Mike Lindell. Some of you might know who he is at the time of this recording. He is the person who started the MyPillow company here in the U.S., very good pillows, by the way, the best pillows I've ever had. I bought some years ago, and they're very good. But he started a company in Minnesota here in the U.S., and it's been very successful and all that. But he became an outspoken critic of what happened in the 2020 elections, and very supportive of Trump, very openly supportive of him, and they started going after him, the media and everybody. They started demonetizing, the cancel culture went after him and, criticized him, mocked him, and so forth. And the story I heard today was that MyPillow, the name of his company, has this bank that they work with. This worthless bank called Heartland Financial Minnesota Bank and Trust. And the bastards at that bank told him, we don't want you anymore. And they're canceling him, canceling his accounts. He has charity accounts with them, because this man is a born-again Christian. He's a recovering drug addict or alcoholic, I forget, but he was addicted to something. And he was he was born again. His life was changed, and he now has charities to help people with addictions and things like that. And the bank is saying, no, we don't want them anymore. And someone interviewed the CEO, I think, or someone related or near the CEO, and they were questioning why they were doing this. And apparently, their concern was that he was a reputation risk. In other words, Mike Lindell is still doing all these things, saying all these things, and if anyone realizes that we're associated with him because he has his accounts with us, then it's going to harm our reputation. So we are kind of cutting him off. And I don't agree with some of the things that Mike Lindell has done. I know his heart is means well, but I think he doesn't understand the methodology that needs to be applied, and so he's limited in his understanding. But I admire him for his braveness and boldness in doing what he's done, and so they're cutting him off. So what they're trying, so what has been happening is this: there's the systematic attack on his reputation, And they're kind of trying to ostracize him, trying to vilify him so that no one associates with him. And the purpose is to destroy him. They are discrediting him. You know, I've heard and seen, comedy sketches done on television mocking him, ridiculing him. When a lot of people are doing so many worse things, much worse than what Mike Lindell could possibly be doing, and they are not mocked. So his reputation is being destroyed, attacked and destroyed. And that's when we start seeing what the right to a fair reputation is about. The right to a fair reputation is the right to criticize, to judge, to make judgments about others. And have your reputation protected as you do so. Obviously, if you're saying lies, then your reputation should be attacked or destroyed. But it's basically the right to speak up and to say, to declare judgment and say, this is right, this is wrong, and calling people out without the fear of you being attacked ad hominem, having ad hominem attacks against you to try to discredit you and destroy you. And the right to a fair reputation, when it comes under attack, it has certain qualities or symptoms about it. And I know I'm running out of time here. This snippet ran for too long, I guess, to finally get to this point. But we'll try to say some things quickly and continue in the next audio snippet, hopefully. So the first thing that, or one of the things that you can see in an attack on someone's fair reputation is that it's basically associated with surface accusations. And what do we mean by that? It's accusations where they take something that you really did say, and they, because they don't understand the spirit of what you said, or they refuse to understand the spirit of what you were saying, they take it and put it completely out of context and twist it around enough so that you start looking like an idiot. For example, what happened with, but this is partially Trump's fault, when he said something about bleach and the virus, and I remember hearing the statement. I heard it, heard a recording of it, and I think I kind of understood where he was going. And he was doing what I would consider like lateral thinking. I'm not sure what the term is, but he was trying to kind of think out of the box. Maybe that's the easiest or the best way to describe it. Like a child, but not in a bad way. He was saying, you know, there must be a way to attack this virus, because he was like using common sense and saying, okay, if the virus is on a surface and you apply bleach on it, you kill it. So the virus can be killed. So how can we do the same thing? He was saying, how can we do something like something that you can inject into the body and act like bleach, you know, in the sense that it's going and destroying those virus cells, you know, without harming the body. And they kind of took it out of context and basically said, oh, he said recommending that people inject themselves with bleach. But I believe that this is, was partly Trump's fault, because I'm convinced that before that press conference that he where he said that, I'm sure that somebody started putting that into his head, or saying it in such a way that they were kind of feeding the thought into his head, hoping that he would somehow say it so that they could then accuse him of it. And he fell for it, because he stupidly, to this day, like an idiot, continues to surround himself with people who are there to betray him. And I think in a sense, you could say that he did fulfill his that intent of finding some sort of bleach that kills the virus when he promoted Operation Warp Speed and promoted all these lethal injections. And now people are basically injecting the kind of an equivalent of bleach, because these spike proteins that are being created, put into your body through this mRNA technology, it's basically destroying your body. So it's killing the virus, but it's killing the virus and the whole host, because that's the easiest way to kill the virus. Just kill the person, just put, you know, blow their brains out, then the person is dead, the virus is dead, and no more host for the virus, and you have won. So in a sense, he has kind of done that. What they accused him of doing, he ended up doing almost literally. But when he said it, he didn't mean it. But they took this surface comment, instead of saying, okay, yeah, let's do this like a child. Let's think this, you know, because children have these innovative ideas, because they're not bound by boxes, you know, by the paradigms that adults have. So you know, they think out of the box, and that's how you can create some wonderful ideas sometimes. thinking like a child. And that's what he was doing. He's saying, okay, can we do something where we can target specifically, you know, kill this thing, because we can kill it. But it has to be out on the surface where we can apply bleach on it. But how can we do that inside the body? So he was, you know, just doing what I would call like lateral thinking or things like that. But they took this out of context, and so that's one of the qualities in an attack on someone's fair reputation, where they take what you say and they just do a surface accusation. They just peel the what's on the surface and then twist it enough to then attack you with their own words. But that's because there's a disconnect of those people with the spirit of what you're saying. They don't understand the spirit of what you're saying. That's why they didn't understand what Trump was saying. Trump was being creative or trying to be creative, but unfortunately he was using words that were put into his head by the people around him before that press conference, setting him up so that he would say that out loud and then be attacked for it. So that's one thing. Another quality is systematic attacks. There's a systematic nature about the attack on your fair reputation. It's like people start ganging up on you, start devising strategies, and it seems to come from all fronts. Because it's very systematic, very organized. There's something very, what I call teacherly, very organized about it. And again, it's very surface-like because it's very literal, just taking your words literally and without the spirit of the words. And the third quality is there's always an intent to punish and neutralize. And that's when you see, okay, my right to a fair reputation is being attacked. When it's not just, see, it's different than as opposed to like someone's giving an opinion about a public figure and saying, oh, he's evil, he's that, he's the other. But he's saying an opinion. He's saying he's saying his thoughts about that person. But it's different when that person, but he's just talking, and it's a battle of ideas. But when the other person is attacking you, and his intent is to destroy you, destroy your life. That's what they're trying to do with Mike Lindell. Destroy his business, destroy his life, make his life miserable. That's what they've done to Laura Loomer and other people here in the U.S. The YouTube, PayPal, all these bastards, like, you know, that little Indian bastard boy, Sundar Pichai, he'll burn in hell, that little son of a bitch, that Indian untouchable bastard boy, and that other little white liberal whore, Jack Dorsey from Twitter, and all these bastards, they demonetize those who disagree with them, and they vilify them, and they say, oh, these are promoting misinformation, and they start labeling you with all these labels that you are this liar, and this ultra-right-wing nut job, and blah, 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 and they put all these things, but it's very systematic, with an intent to punish you and neutralize you and destroy you. And that's when you see the right to a fair reputation being attacked. And it's associated to the first thing we said about the surface accusation, is this pretending to be objective. Because it's different to have an opinion as opposed to a statement of fact. If I say I have an opinion about Trump and I say what I say, it's different from saying, you know, Trump was born in 1952. I mean, I have no idea when he was born. But if I say Trump was born in 1952, he either was born in 52 or not born in 52. That's just a statement of fact. It's an objective, verifiable statement of fact. And when people try to attack your fair reputation, a quality inherent in it is this pretending of objectivity. Like, we're just stating facts, and we are declaring that you are incorrect and that you're doing all these wrong things based on these facts, when in fact what they're doing is stating opinion and twisted opinion at that. So there's this pretension of objectivity when it's actually opinion. And that's a very important thing when dealing with whether something is really attacking your reputation or not. you have to kind of measure it against, okay, are they pretending to be objective? Like when they close accounts on Twitter and other places saying you are spreading misinformation about the virus because the CDC says this. Well, they are saying, well, whatever the CDC says is true. And how do so they are acting like there are these objective and partial fact checkers when they're really not at all that. And that's when you're saying, okay, my reputation is being attacked. When they are labeling me a misinformer, they are saying I am a liar and therefore no one should listen to me. So those are four elements in detecting when your right to a fair reputation is being attacked. And I think we have run way too long, and we'll continue all of this in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.